In the UK, funeral directors, along with the coroner, are considered the gatekeepers to the cemetery. It is the funeral director's responsibility to report any unusual findings in regards to the body of the deceased, and the coroner's responsibility to investigate what may have happened. This system has been in place in the UK for hundreds of years, and it is meant to provide reassurance that any suspected foul play will be investigated.
Imagine that I pick a deceased up from the hospital and I bring that deceased back to my funeral home, and I'm in the mortuary, and as I'm rolling this deceased over to dress them, I see a puncture wound or a knife hanging out of their back. I have an obligation to report those concerns for two reasons. One, I have a legal obligation to do that. Legally, I have to report it, and I report that to my local coroner. And then number two, I have a moral obligation as a decent human being. I've got concerns. So I contacted my local coroner and voiced these concerns. I did that via an email. They didn't respond to the email. I got a call from one of the girls in the office 4 or 5 days later, and she said she'd spoken to the pathologist. He was happy with everything that he'd found when he'd looked at this deceased, and that he didn't need any samples and I should get rid of them. And he then suggested that this rubber grows inside deceased post-mortem. So basically, when you die, rubber fills your arteries, which is fantasy. It's just pure fantasy, you know. And if it wasn't, I would have seen it in 18 years that I've been in the industry.
After the inadequate response from his local coroner, John decided to escalate the issue.
There is not one death, it's loads of deaths, and I didn't seem to be getting anywhere with the local coroner. And I have to maintain a working relationship with these people. What do I do? Do I start screaming liar down the phone? You can't. So I go to his boss, and that's the Chief Coroner of England. And I wrote to them voicing concerns, and I said, look, we're seeing an unprecedented number of young deaths coming through. They're not COVID. We're finding these unnatural clots. What is it? You know, what are you doing about it? And I didn't get a reply. So then 3 weeks later, I wrote again, and they basically said, we have to follow government policy. It's not for us to change government policy. So clearly, government policy is that they don't talk about it.
I see. Across the pond, the government policy is that they don't talk about things like rubbery blood clots just showing up in the deceased during the past 3 years. Funny, that's happened here too, often enough, wouldn't you say? Well, we are going to get to it tonight. At last. Good evening, everyone. I'm Joyce Kamen, a member of the FLCCC Board of Directors, here with you again as Betsy continues to have some bumps on her road to recovery from eye surgery. She is sending her love to all, and your well wishes in the chat would really lift her spirits. We'll see you soon, Bets. So, why are embalmers finding unusual amyloid-like blood clots in the bloodstreams of the deceased? We will get to this very important conversation with retired U.S. Air Force Major Thomas Haviland, who conducted a comprehensive survey analysis of these white fibrous clots that have been observed by embalmers across the world. And we will also be joined by Richard Hirschman, an embalmer who appeared on the film Died Suddenly, who says that the clots are in both the venous as well as the arterial systems, where they are not expected to be seen. With Pierre and Paul off tonight, we are thrilled to welcome pathologist Dr. Ryan Cole, a dear friend of the FLCCC, as tonight's guest host. Dr. Cole will lead this discussion and provide answers to many of the questions that may arise surrounding this trouble issue from a medical perspective. So let's get this long-awaited conversation started right now. Good evening to Dr. Cole, to Major Haviland, and to Mr. Hirschman. Hello, gentlemen.
Good evening.
It is great to have you here. And Dr. Cole, I'm going to let you start things off. You know a little bit about this subject, but what's top of mind to you as we start this conversation with Richard and Tom about what they've been seeing and what they have been finding and what we have not been hearing enough about?
Well, first, I want to say thank you to everybody for allowing me to guest host tonight and join you, Joyce. And I'm honored to be joined by our guests, Major Thomas Haviland and Richard Hirschman, who I've gotten to know over the last couple of years. And I liked that intro with John O'Looney out of the UK. You know, each of us have traveled a fair amount in the last couple of years. And when we go through the airport, what do we hear? We hear, if you see something, say something. And I want to commend the heroism of both Richard and Thomas for speaking out, because in pathology, you know, when we do an autopsy or case review, you know, we see things in cross section. At autopsy, generally, we'll look at the larger vessels within the body cavity, but we don't get to see what's happening in the peripheral circulation at that time. Top of mind concern for me is this still going on. What are the mechanisms behind why it's going on? And to what degree are we still seeing it? And to what degree are we going to continue to see it in the future? So I want to kick it off by asking these fine gentlemen, you know, what they're still seeing and what they're hearing from their colleagues around the world. And I know Thomas has a presentation for us, which we'll see. But, you know, let's kick it off with that. You know, what are you guys still seeing this far into the untoward medical intervention, shall we call it?
Hey, Richard, why don't you start by saying what you're seeing right now in your embalming rooms?
Well, the actual amount of work that I'm doing has decreased. However, most of the funeral homes are shocked by the increase of cremations nowadays, and I believe that's due to economic reasons. But just as an example, I mean, you know, these are all recent. So we're still seeing this on a regular basis, again, like you did on the intro. These are also not just venous, but arterial as well. It comes in waves. Sometimes there's times I don't see it as often as others. And then next thing you know, this one after the other, I find these strange clots. They're not always super large, but they're appearing in younger people as well. It was originally mostly the elderly. And it seems like the age groups are decreasing. I get images from other embalmers from across the country with their images as well. I posted one on my Twitter recently that was 48 inches long. And that was from an artery. Again, we used to hardly never, ever would see clots in arteries. It was almost always in veins. And typically they were red jelly-like, and there was no way we could hold on to one clot and hold its structure of that length.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, Richard. You know, by way of history, in medicine and pathology, in embalming, you have I think the audience needs to know what your background in history is. You know, you're not new to this game. You've been doing this for a while, and you know, if the audience will please forgive the analogy, but in medicine, especially in pathology, we have food descriptors. So, you know, historically we would see clots that were grape jelly like or chicken fatty, and these aren't those. And please share from your background, you know, how long you've been doing this, and you know, the degree to which you've seen this prior to these last couple of years.
Right. Well, I don't remember the exact date I started in the funeral business as far as as working as a funeral director and embalmer. But I do remember as an apprentice being in the funeral home on 9/11. So, I mean, I've now been doing this for we're getting close to 23 years at least now. So 23 years of doing this at and it wasn't until 2021, which would have been, you know, 20 years after I started. Have I seen clots before? Absolutely, we've seen clots, just like you described. They're red in color. Sometimes we can pull them out, but they're so fragile. They just typically will fall apart. You can't really manipulate them much. And these kind of clots, these white fibrous clots, I did not start seeing these until early 2021. I usually said estimated around May, but that's a guess. I believe it was a little earlier than that, maybe in April or March, but I know by May I seen it, and definitely no later than June.
What did you think the first time you saw that?
I was shocked. I thought, wow, that's weird. Never seen anything like that before. And as a matter of fact, the first time that if I can think back in my brain, my mental history here, I was having trouble getting fluid down an arm and I had to raise the axillary or brachial artery. I prefer the axillary. It's up a little higher. The artery is a little larger. And when I opened up the artery, I saw this strange substance that looked like a clot, a blood clot, had a little bit of blood to it. But when I took my forceps and I pinched it and I started pulling it out, it was extremely long and it had this white fibrous look in it, but I don't remember exactly when that was. And that was like the first time I was like, holy smokes, this is weird. But then as time went on, I started seeing it again and again. So in the very beginning, I thought it was an anomaly, something that was really strange. I didn't know what it was. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a mortician. And you know, the intro that you did with John O'Looney, people ask me this, you know, John O'Looney says he has a moral obligation to report these things to the authorities. Now, in mortuary school, where I went to school, we were trained that everything that happens in the embalming room stays in the embalming room, and we don't need to go out there and talk about what happens there. We are taught that if we see, let's say, you know, a bullet hole in the back of somebody's head, and yet it wasn't reported, and they think this is a normal death, then yes, we have a moral obligation to say, hey, there's an apparent crime here. But with these strange clots, we don't look at that as a criminal. And I think that's one of the reasons it's a little bit different. I didn't feel necessarily a moral obligation at the time when I first started seeing these is, here's a really weird clot. Let me call up the police and say, hey, I found a weird clot here. This is weird. They'll laugh at me and they'll sit there and just be like, you know, I mean, who are you? You're not a doctor. So I didn't. But I did start feeling the moral push, the moral obligation to speak as the year progressed. And I started seeing this more and more and more often. And it wasn't until September that I took the first photograph of this strange substance. I was already asking other embalmers, they were seeing it. And I was being, not coerced, but kind of pushed a little bit by others in my field saying, somebody needs to bring this to the public's attention. Somebody needs to say something, but nobody was willing to do it. I mean, most of these people work for corporations and they have businesses and they've seen what happened to people like Dr. Ryan Cole, many of the other doctors that have been just bombarded with lawsuits and, you know, being criticized and try to ruin his reputation. I mean, so it did become a moral thing. And I've been accused of by some people, not a lot, but by some people, that what I'm doing is unethical. You know,
why unethical?
Because what happens in the embalming room is supposed to stay there. You know, I mean, we're not supposed to talk about the weird, the stuff that we see in the embalming room.
It's like Fight Club.
Yeah. But the problem is I was losing sleep over this. I was starting to really, really struggle emotionally and spiritually that these people that were saying somebody's got to say something. It is true. I mean, like Dr. Cole said, we've been taught for the last several years, if you see something, say something. And then all of a sudden you got doctors that were speaking up in 2021 as they're seeing weird things, starting to say something, and they're thrown into the cuckoo club and called conspiracy theorists, losing their privileges at some hospitals. My wife's doctor wanted to give her ivermectin when she was diagnosed with COVID, but she said she wasn't allowed to. She wasn't allowed to prescribe what she thought my wife needed. It's crazy, isn't it? Doesn't it seem kind of strange? So these people weren't wanting to talk. And I think the reason why I'm a little bit different than some of the embalmers that are willing to speak up is because I am a trade embalmer. I don't work for a corporation. I don't work for these funerals. I'm not a W-2 employee. I'm a contractor. So I have several funeral homes that I work for, and because their name isn't attached to me, or my name's not attached to them, they can kind of go unnoticed, even though some of them don't want me to mention their names of the place where I work. So
Well, I'm glad, Richard, that you did speak out. And what I did is I did a couple of worldwide surveys to quantify, because we only have the anecdotal, you know, evidence from several embalmers like Richard, John O'Looney, and several others, that what I call the Magnificent Seven that is spoken out in the Died Suddenly movie. So then I went ahead and did two worldwide embalmer blackout surveys to try to corroborate or negate what these six or seven embalmers said they were seeing. So I'll share my screen now and show you the results of my latest survey.
Hey, Tom, give people your background real quick. I mean, you're a former Air Force guy like me. And I mean, you're not coming to this as just some random person. You have an interesting background and a very analytical mind. So I like the approach you took into gathering this data. But tell folks real quick that don't know you a little bit about your background.
Sure. I'm Tom Havlin from Dayton, Ohio. I have a bachelor's in mathematics from The Ohio State University, bachelor's in electrical engineering from Louisiana Tech University, and a master's in computer resources and information management from Webster University in St. Louis. Spent 20 years in the United States Air Force, retired at the rank of major, then spent an additional 16 years with the Air Force as a defense contractor, working with really neat aircraft like the F-16 Falcon, the F-22 Raptor, the F-117 Stealth Fighter. Loved my work, but it all came to an abrupt halt in October of 2021 when I refused to take the COVID-19 vaccine as a defense contractor working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. And a three-star Air Force general had sent out an email to the entire base telling everybody the date they had to get the shots by or else get kicked out. I sent him back an email saying, "Shame on you." Instead of standing up for our right to decide for ourselves whether or not to get injected with an experimental drug, you chose to spend your time trying to guilt us into taking the jab. Shame on you. And I didn't just send the email to him, Ryan. I CC'd all 30,000 people that work at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. And I knew what was going to happen. I got a call a half hour later from my defense contractor boss, and I was fired from my $165,000 a year job as an electrical engineer, but it was well worth it. I don't regret what I did. I consider the colonels and generals to be cowards and tyrants who pushed this unlawful mandate down on everybody. And I stood my ground, and I'm glad that I did.
Well, thanks for doing that. And so people know.
And that led me then to, since I was retired, it gave me the time, Ryan, to do these worldwide embalmer blood clot surveys I'm going to show you. Now, the first survey that I did that covered through the year 2022, 179 embalmers responded to that survey. 119 of them, almost exactly two-thirds, 66%, said they were indeed seeing the white fibrous clots in their corpses through the year 2022. Most of them saw the clots starting in 2021, like Richard talked about. There were 44 of the embalmers of the 119 that said they did see the white fibrous clots in the year 2020, which is interesting because that's the year that we had COVID, but no vaccines yet. And the theory there is that, you know, there's a spike protein on the virus itself, right? And that spike protein could be leading to the formation of these amyloid proteins. But then many more of the embalmers saw the clots starting in 2021. And the really shocking thing from that first survey, Ryan, is that of the 119 that saw the clots, in fact, of all of them, when you average them together, they saw an average of the clots in an average of 30% of their corpses. And that's including the embalmers that didn't see any. When you even include that number, 30% on average, and some of the embalmers were seeing the clots in up to 50% or more of their corpses, such as Richard was. So then I ran the survey again here in December of this last year, 2023, the 8th of December through the 8th of January. And here are the results we're going to talk about for this survey. So we asked the embalmers, how much experience do you have? And as you can see there, pretty good amount of experience, right? A long bar there for embalmers with over 20 years of experience, you know, 15 years on average. So this is good, right? They know what the blood looked like prior to the year 2019 and prior to COVID. They know what it looked like in the year of COVID, 2020, and then the years 2021 to present when we had both COVID and the vaccines. We then asked them, how many corpses do you embalm per year? 100 corpses on average, so about two a week. Richard does many more than that. Richard will do two or three bodies a day sometimes. He's a busy trade embalmer. So we asked them again this year, Ryan, did you observe the large white fibrous clots? As you can see there, 197 of the 269 embalmers that responded to this year's survey. So we got about 90 more responses this year, which was great. Still not as many as I'd like to have had, but better than last year. But of those 197, 73% are still seeing the white fibrous clots in the year 2023. So this is still a problem. We then asked them, what percentage of your corpses in 2023 had the clots? And if you average all those bars together, including the green bar, where 63 of the embalmers said they saw none, you still get an average of 20% of the corpses containing these white fibrous clots in 2023. If you look over there to the left, you'll see 48 of the embalmers saw the clots between 21 to 40% of their corpses. 29 of the embalmers saw the white fibrous clots between 41 to 60% of the corpses. And 11 embalmers saw between 61 to 80% of their corpses still in 2023. Now, the good news is as an average, it's down from the 30% that we saw last year. But you might expect that if the COVID vaccines, most people took their last COVID vaccines way back in 2021. According to the CDC, 80% of American adults over the age of 18 took at least the first two jabs back in 2021. Only about 20% of American adults over the age of 18 took the BA4, BA5 bivalent Omicron booster in the fall of 2022, and only about 10 to 15% took the latest XBB 1.5 booster that came out last fall of 2023. So you might expect if the vaccines are causing these clots, that the percentage of corpses with them might start to go down as you get further and further away from people taking their last jabs. One of the other things we talked, Richard and the other embalmers noticed is what they call coffee grounds or dirty blood in the drainage coming off the corpse. This is an indication of a phenomenon you know called microclotting, Ryan. And look at that number there. Of the 269 embalmers that responded to this year's survey, 79% of them, 212 embalmers, saw this phenomenon in 2023. Now, this is a phenomenon they have seen prior to COVID and the vaccines and prior to 2019. They see it very rarely in their corpses, particularly in patients that had heavy chemotherapy, so less than 5% of corpses. But if you average all those bars together again, including the zero, none, where 49 embalmers said they saw none in the way of microclotting, you still get an average of 25% of corpses in 2023 having this microclotting problem. And as Richard's told me, he said, Tom, it's been a total shift of, the blood, he said, used to be about 10 to 15% of the corpses would have what he would call abnormal blood. 85% would have normal blood prior to the years of COVID and the vaccines. Richard says that's now been a total flip, and now it's about 85% of the corpses that he's seeing have some kind of problem with the blood, abnormal blood, and only about 10 to 15% of corpses now these days have what he refers to as normal blood. So, and as you know, this can be just as dangerous as these white fibrous clots. This microclotting occurs at the capillary level, blocking, the exchange of oxygen into the lungs and then the carrying that oxygen to all your major organs of the body. So it can be just as serious a problem as the large white fibrous clots. We then asked them, again, about grape jelly clots. As you see, if you average the bars together, it's 40% of corpses in 2023 contained grape jelly clots. We asked them, how's that compared to the years prior to COVID, 2019 and prior? They did see grape jelly clots in 30% of their corpses prior to COVID and the vaccines, but that's still an increase from 30 up to 40%. And also, Richard and the other embalmers have told me that the clots are now more like grape jam than they are grape jelly. They've actually gotten thicker over the last few years as well. One of the other areas, and you may want to elaborate on this a little bit, Richard, is infant deaths. Some of the embalmers have said that, hey, I've been seeing an increase in infant deaths. This is really a sad area, right? I guess the good news is that the bulk of the embalmers that responded to the survey, 184 of them, said they were not seeing this. But there were 57 embalmers, 21%, that said they did. And when the next question we asked them, well, what percentage of your infant deaths did you see, in what percent increase did you see in 2023 compared to the years prior to COVID? For those that saw the increase, so if you do not include the blue bar, but if you average the yellow bar on down, it's a 25% increase in infant deaths in 2023 compared to the pre-COVID years for just those 20% of embalmers that did see an increase. Richard, do you want to make any comment about the infant deaths before we go on?
Well, I think you know, when it comes to the infant deaths, a lot of babies, like the majority of the little ones that I see are typically the fetal demises. And most of them are not embalmed. So you're asking embalmers these questions. And if the embalmer is just, you know, we're just, you know, we don't embalm a lot of the little babies. Not saying we can't, but usually if they're really small, we can't do it. And then there are some places that, you know, there's some places have contracts with hospitals. So, you know, smaller areas might not see an increase because wherever the hospital or the thing is, they might recommend a particular funeral home. So I think that number can be easily skewed. When these kind of percentage numbers, I think you're better off getting that data from somebody like people that work in the labor and delivery and OBGYN doctors like Dr. Thorpe and
got
others.
Okay.
Yeah, and Dr. Thorpe, Dr. Biss, Dr. Mm-hmm. McGuire, there's a bunch of OBs that have come forward now, and there's another one coming forward in California. So yeah, that data is concerning. In fact, I had a friend visiting the other night, and her son and his wife can't have children, so they've adopted one. They're trying to adopt again, and they were in a pool of 1 out of 30 about a year and a half ago. And interestingly, that adoption pool has gone to, they're now 1 out of 480 on that list.
Oh my goodness.
So I think that's, you know, again, anecdotal, but at the same time, and it's interesting when you do start aggregating the data. But anyway, I'll let you keep going on. But
you're right. And we've seen papers that have come out that said that the spike protein from the vaccine, it's getting through the breast milk from the mother to the child, right? It's also, they found the spike protein in the delivered placentas of correct. Women after childbirth. So, you know, this is very unfortunate that it appears that it's getting through from the mother to the infant. One of the other things we did this year that we did not get a chance to do last year is check on stratification by age group. We wanted to see if there was an increase in any type of clotting, whether it's grape jelly, white fibers, or microclotting in any particular age group compared to the years prior to COVID. And as you can see there, they're positive bars for all. So all age groups are being affected. The largest, longest bars are in the older age groups. One of the bars that particularly concerns me, though, is that 36 to 50-year-old bar. You see 89 embalmers responded. They saw an increase in clotting in that age group compared to the pre-COVID years. And this dovetails very closely with the data that Edward Dowd's been collecting from death and disability insurance data. He saw a tremendous spike in death and disability in that 36 to 50-year-old age group starting in the third quarter of 2021. And so, you know, it's not a surprise to me, I guess, that the embalmers said they're also seeing a spike in clotting in that particular age group as well. So that wasn't too much of a surprise. So I'll go ahead and I'll unshare my screen now. Those were the main results of the current survey. So when I had that finished, Dr. Cole, I actually finished that on the 8th of January. The very next day, on the 9th of January, I sent those results off to Mandy Cohen at the CDC, Robert Califf, I think, is the head of the FDA, and also to Monica Bertagnoli, who's the head of the NIH, with the full results, the PowerPoint presentation I just showed, plus all my SurveyMonkey files as well. Just like I did last year, I sent them off last year to the FDA in time for their vaccine and related biological products advisory committee meeting that was on the 26th of January of last year. And I did get a tracking number for submission I sent to them in writing. But throughout the whole year last year, nor the first 4 months of this year, Dr. Cole, I have not heard a peep out of the FDA or the CDC. It's a shame, isn't it, that a retired Air Force guy has to do this? Why do I have to do this?
Well, and I think this is the interesting point. You know, those who have spoken up have been very independently minded, obviously. And we have corruption and regulatory capture within these agencies. I don't think it's as though they don't know what's going on, but I think their paymasters, whoever the, you know, mysterious they are, behind the scenes are keeping them silent, and silence is compliance. And, you know, I think back to the 80s, and we discover, you know, new diseases and have problems in our blood supply. And all of a sudden, you know, there's a worldwide panic because there's a handful of cases in hemophiliacs with HIV from transfusions, and that makes the world press. Yet here we have percentages in the 20s and 30 plus percents of something changing in the blood, and yet the world is silent. And I you know, again, I commend Richard for, you know, amongst his circle of the colleagues he was working with, to be the one that stepped forward. And in the work you've done, you know, Tom, has been amazing in terms of aggregating these opinions, or not opinions, but these observations from professionals. And I think that's so important that, you know, you got pushback from these professional organizations when you were trying to get them to even just answer the survey. And you went to the 30 most populated states, and you finally got some traction. But I think that a lot of people like to hide behind anonymity, and it makes it easier for them to say what they're seeing. But at the same time, I think we're at this critical point in history where this type of thing in society will continue to happen if people don't speak up. And so, again, I commend both of your work, and especially your courage for speaking up. And I think what we're trying to do at this point is understand why is this happening. And you brought up the correct point, Tom, that spike protein, whether from the infection itself or from the genetic code that programs for the part of the virion that causes clotting, that spike protein, you know, was injected into billions of people. And you know, Dr. McCullough still talks about having a couple of patients a week, years from their last injection, that are still forming these clinically. So these aren't just post-mortem findings. And I think that's an important point to bring forward. I know, Richard, in pre-conversation, you were going to mention that you may have a couple of whistleblowers, or was it you, Tom? One of you were talking.
Actually, I've got, yeah.
Yeah, that was you,
Tom. Before we go there, I want to tell a little story. You kind of alluded to it. One of the things that I looked it up the other day, there's like 23,000 funeral homes across the United States alone. Richard was the very first embalmer to come forward in the U.S. about the white fibrous clots. And people ask, well, why aren't more embalmers coming forward? And like you said, it was actually pulling teeth for me, because I sent my survey out to 1,700 funeral homes around the world. I sent it out to 50 national, regional, and state funeral director associations, each with hundreds of member funeral directors and embalmers under them. Around, you know, around the world, to try to get them to take the survey. And this latest survey, that I started the survey on the 8th of December, and after about 5 days, on the 13th of December, I only had about 14 responses in my SurveyMonkey collectors. I said, what's going on here? I need more responses than this. So I called the 30 U.S. state funeral director associations I had sent the survey to, and I talked to either their president or secretary or somebody else in their office, and I said, hey, could you please forward that email that I sent you last week to all your active embalmers so they can take the survey? Well, God bless the Pennsylvania Funeral Directors Association, Dr. Cole. They did exactly as I asked. I know that because I got up the next day, I had 93 responses from embalmers, and they were all from one state, Pennsylvania. I then got up the next day, and I had 32 more responses from embalmers, and they were all from one state, Pennsylvania. So in 2 days, I got 125 responses from embalmers in a single U.S. state. And it told me two things. It told me, first of all, the embalmers, they want to tell you what they're seeing in the embalming room if they think they have the permission of their funeral director boss or their state funeral director association. But remember, I also sent that to 29 other U.S. state funeral director associations. They must have deleted my email, not even sent it down to their embalmers to take in the first place. So when people ask you what's going on there, this is what's happening. You've got all these funeral homes, all these embalmers, and Richard, when I was down visiting with him last year, he took me around the day before we actually had an interview with Cheryl Atkinson, you know, for Full Measure to do her TV show. I visited three of the funeral homes that Richard works with. Every single person in the funeral home said, oh yeah, the clots are happening, but they won't come out publicly. They let Richard do it, but they stay silent themselves. So it's this big cover-up. And now we're finding out the same thing is happening amongst the living as well. Dr. Philip McMillan, who runs a YouTube channel called Vegan Health over in the UK, has found a whistleblower here in the United States that works in a cath lab, a catheterization lab, which, you know, is a lab that's used to extract clots from the living, right? Traditionally, grape jelly clots or chicken fat clots. Now these white fibrous clots. Well, he's got a whistleblower that's come forward, and I have found my own whistleblower somewhere here in the United States who doesn't want to come forward either because they're afraid of having their licenses pulled, their board certifications taken away. Mine's actually a cardiologist, is also an endovascular surgeon. So, but what's interesting is the one that's talked to, Dr. Philip McMillan, has 20 years of experience as an endovascular specialist. He started seeing the white fibrous clots in late 2021. He's actually now pulling these white fibrous clots out of anywhere between 3 to 10 patients per week in his one cath lab alone. He says what they usually do when the person's come in with clotting problems, the doctors immediately will give them heparin or clot-busting drugs, and they do a good job of breaking up the grape jelly clots. They don't seem to have any effect at all on these white fibrous clots. So then they have to go in and get them with catheters. They either have suction devices on the end or a scraping tool that scrapes it out of the vein or artery. Remember, these labs are staffed with vascular surgeons, cardiologists, endovascular specialists, anesthesiologists, radiologists, nurses. So there's a bunch of people watching these white fibrous clots being removed from living people, but they're not talking about it.
And, so, and that's 3 to 10 per week currently still.
Yes, because he did the interview with this gentleman only about a month, or I think it's been about 2 months since he did the interview. So that's pretty current. And by the way, this cath lab whistleblower of Dr. Philip McMillan, he has the receipts. In the Substack video that's shown, he shows about 6 different clots that were removed, plus the angiograms, you know, like the x-rays of inside the body. He also has access to all the vaccination records, COVID vaccination records of all his patients. And guess what? Whenever they find the white fibrous clots, 99% of those patients have taken anywhere between 1 to 8 COVID jabs. And the problem seems to be worse the more COVID jabs you take, according to this cath lab whistleblower.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, I saw the question run by in the chat here, how long does that spike protein stick around in the body? The answer is we don't know. Dr. Brogna and colleagues out of Europe had done a study on post-vaccination circulation of spike protein. And in half of patients, you know, kind of to those percentages you were bringing up earlier, Tom, in half of those patients, the spike protein was still circulating 6 months later. And again, you know, this wasn't a traditional, quote, vaccine. This was a genetic injection. And if you look at Moderna and Pfizer, they're listed with the Securities and Exchange Commissions as gene therapies. And if we go back to the 80s and the 90s, gene therapies failed for a reason. And the number one reason they failed was actually clotting. So this is history repeating itself. We knew this historically in medicine when we were tinkering with genetic studies a long time ago. And not just Pfizer and Moderna, but I think looking at the adenovirus vector vaccines, the J&J, the AstraZeneca, what both of those, and obviously J&J was pulled from the market. Why? Because of clotting. And in those cases, some patients form in the blood an antibody against their own platelet. It's called platelet factor number 4. And there's actually a laboratory test to check for that antibody. And that antibody binds to the platelets and causes those platelets to clump. So it's not surprising with the unknown duration of both the activity of the gene. And a lot of people, here's good news, a lot of people are fine. So, you know, I think what we're talking about is obviously a societal concern to a set percentage. If you look at the great work of a study group out of Denmark, they looked at their population, about a third didn't even have a sore arm. They had no symptoms. It was as though they had almost received a placebo. About two-thirds had, you know, moderate symptoms after their injection, but there are 4 to 5% that had severe reactions. If you go into our own CDC VSafe data and the great work of Aaron Seary and Del Bigtree and ICANN, you know, look, 10 million people, 7.7% had severe reactions that required medical attention. So it's not everyone. So I think that's an important part for those listening to remember, you know. There's a Zogby survey as well about a year and change ago that showed out of 100 Americans that got the shot, 15 had a new medical condition thereafter. Well, that means 85% didn't. So I think it's important to emphasize that we're still learning medically. We're analyzing these clots. You know, they are proteinaceous. They are thicker than normal clots, like you guys have described so correctly. And the great work of Dr. Jordan Vaughn of the FLCCC, Dr. Raisa Pretorius, Douglas Kell out of the UK, Jaco Laustrup, they've looked at these and shown that there are amyloid-like proteins. And amyloid is a type of protein. You may hear of amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's disease. Historically, that was a type of amyloid. Well, what amyloid is a folded protein that's hard to break apart because of the type of chemical bonds that form between those proteins. So a lot of these traditional, as you pointed out, these traditional medicines that we have used for clot busting historically are tending not to work. There is a genetic predisposition for some people. There's a gene called plasminogen activator inhibitor number one, the G4 and the G5 forms of this gene. And it's important, you know, in some patients that are having microclotting problems to get tested for that. LabCorp, Quest, I think they both do it, and it takes like 2 weeks to get that because it's a gene test. But some people have, you know, underlying pre-existing clotting conditions, and you add this on top of that. And it's interesting, you know, whether you got COVID and had some clotting, because we saw an increase of pulmonary emboli during COVID, but then after the injections in 21, then the form of these clots, the proteinaceous material in these clots changed. And so I think understanding your own personal history is critically important. And we, you know, science evolves. There's no such thing as consensus in science. If there were, science would end. So, you know, we're advancing the science. That's what we do. Science is a process. Science is a verb, not a noun. Well, unless it's trademarked by Fauci, but that's different. Exactly. But anyway, I think it's important to understand, don't panic, but at the same time, make sure that you know your personal medical history and you're doing the things that you can do. Anything else you want to add, Richard, in terms of, you know, what you're still working on sure. currently?
Well, I've been working with some folks overseas as well, and they're looking at this through an organic chemistry perspective. They're saying also that these a lot to do with the spike protein, that the spike protein that's generated by through the vaccine is different than the natural spike. It has an open conformation, meaning the spike protein kind of looks like this, and the modified spike protein looks like this, meaning there's a lot more surface area, a lot more opens up a different pathway of additional phosphorylation and things like that, chemistry to connect things together. But through this research and some of these things, I have found papers that stated that the spike protein from SARS-CoV-2 causes abnormal clotting. I mean, that's in their papers. And of course, they're labeling that to the SARS-CoV-2. Well, my question is they already know spike protein causes abnormal blood clotting. Then why are we putting spike protein into the arms of billions of people? And why are we adding an mRNA technology to make the body create more of those spike proteins that can cause abnormal clotting?
Correct.
And another recent finding that I have learned about, and I've heard a lot about thrombocytopenia and this, that, and the other, but one is known as VITT,
mm-hmm.
vaccine-induced immune
thrombocytopenia. Yeah.
Now I've got papers that are, some of them go all the way back to 2008. I mean, not 2008. I'm sorry. November. June. June of 2020-21. This is literally linked to the COVID vaccine. And one of these PMC PubMed abstracts that I read says that, you know, coagulation system leads to high risk of death from venous or arterial thrombosis. Well, when I read that or arterial thrombosis, I remember 20 years of embalming and I would hardly never see any thrombosis in an artery itself. And it's funny, isn't it? How now I see clots in the arteries as well as in veins. But these clots are the same. It's the same weird structure, this white fibrous thing that runs through the artery as looks almost identical to the one that I'm finding in the veins as well.
Yeah, and you sent one of those to me, and one of the arterial ones when you sent me that first batch a while back. I remember seeing an arterial one and my jaw dropped. I thought, wait a minute.
This one here was 18 inches. I came out of the artery.
Yeah, and I think physiologically it's important to understand, you know, your arterial system is under high pressure.
Right.
And so you have high pressure, high flow. So for those listening to understand, you know, to have something form and clot in your arterial system and build over time, that's unusual. Usually your slow, low pressure venous return is where you get these little eddy pools and this slow congealing of proteins and whatnot. So yeah, what you're describing is medically unusual.
Right. And one of the things that I found interesting when I started, I mean, I went and just started pulling off these different papers just off of, you know, just an easy search, a VITT. It is related to the COVID vaccine itself. And of course, in these papers, some of them are going to say that it was linked to J&J and AstraZeneca. And it was extremely rare. In my thing, this is the moral obligation that I feel of why to speak. They said it's extremely rare. Well, if it's extremely rare, then how come I've got almost 280 pictures of these weird clots that yeah. I took myself?
Well, and I think one thing most people don't realize is there are more VAERS reports of clotting with Moderna and Pfizer than there were with J&J. So J&J obviously saw its day, but I think Joyce wants to jump in with a question here.
Well, we have a lot. Actually, it's not my questions, it's viewer questions, and we're coming up to the top of the hour. So I want to get some of these in, and it's pertinent to all of the dimensions of this issue we've discussed tonight. Let
me add one thing before you start.
Sure.
The one whistleblower that I'm working with, the cardiologist here in the United States, who's working in a cath lab, says that almost all of the white fibrous clots that he removes are being thrown away, Ryan. They're not being sent to pathology.
You and I will talk offline because I think there's some things we can do there. Those need to be analyzed and compared to the postmortems, and we can do some proteomic studies on those.
Okay, let's get to some of our viewer questions. Paula asks, what are the simple, inexpensive tests that you know of that can be used to determine if fibrous clots are forming in living persons?
This is a great question because the standard blood tests that one gets in the laboratory generally aren't going to show this, whether it's your PT, PTT, your D-dimer D-dimer is a breakdown product of a clot. So these are stable fibrous clots. So D-dimer was important during the early phases of the pandemic. And it says your body's trying to break down a clot. The short answer, unfortunately, is there isn't an easy test right now. There is a fluorescent microscopic test we can do, and I know only have three labs doing that right now, and it's called a thioflavin T test, and that shows whether or not people are forming these little microfragments of amyloid within the blood. Kind of a real quick side note, to decrease clotting, there's two simple things you can do. Keep your vitamin D level normal, because that's the master conductor of so many clotting factors in your body, and stay hydrated. If I stuck a needle in 100 of you listening right now, 75 of you will be dehydrated. So, you know, simple life things like that are important. There are other genetic tests, VEGF, a couple of other odd measurements where you can see whether or not one's clotting, and that plasminogen PAI1 inhibitor gene, if someone's, and we tend to see that in like women who multiply miscarry, they tend to carry that gene as well. So, you know your family history of clotting, whether you have factor V Leiden or if you have a factor VIII deficiency or things like that, and then just do the simple things and don't worry per se. You know, the older we get, you know, I take a baby aspirin a couple days a week. I know I've seen in the chat nattokinase. That nattokinase is derived from soybean. It's an enzyme. It does break down fibrin. Again, these aren't all fibrin, these clots, but it's Goldilocks, though. Just because a little bit of something's good doesn't mean a whole lot is better. You don't want to cause yourself bleeding in the other direction either. So know your body, know your dose. 100 milligrams, you know, once a day is safe on that. If you're sick with a disease, then, you know, 200 milligrams for a couple of days is okay. But, you know, there are a lot of things you can do. There's not an easy blood test yet. I wish there were. So that's a great question.
So do people who are forming these clots in their bodies have symptoms?
Oh, yes.
Aside from stroke or other, you know, catastrophic illnesses, right, and things that ultimately are very catastrophic, what are the symptoms that people might experience if they're growing these fibrous clots?
Yeah, great question. Because again, as these gents pointed out, you know, a lot of what they're seeing is the coffee ground, not just these big fibrous clots, but those micro clots, those tiny clots. What are your symptoms going to be? Well, fatigue. One of the most important things for your body is oxygen. And these little clots are blocking delivery of oxygen to tissues. So, you know, extreme fatigue, you know, certain regional pains as some of these microvasculature are being clotted off. Some people have had vision problems.
Brain fog.
I saw in the chat again, Michael Nell's book, The Indoctrinated Brain. I strongly recommend that book. He's a researcher out of Germany, a phenomenally well-trained neurologist and great experience. And he goes into a lot of things one can do, including vitamin D, including not getting any more genetic injections. That's another thing you can do. Lithium orotate, you know, not lithium for bipolar disease. The third most common chemical in the Earth's crust is lithium. And it's a mineral that, you know, we get in trace amounts. And lithium orotate actually helps neuronal healing and neuronal firing. But yeah, your symptoms are going to be regional based on the organ system. So that's a great question. It's not all going to be catastrophic.
People want to know, are we to assume that the corpses that you are finding these clots in, these individuals died from these clots ultimately?
Well, I can't say that that's what killed the individual because I'm not a pathologist. All I can do is say whether they're there or not. It's simply my observation. And I do not always know the vaccine status of the individual unless the family discloses that to the funeral director and they tell me. So I can't say that they caused it, but like I said in the beginning or earlier on, or I wanted to say if I didn't say it, is my concern with seeing so many of these strange abnormalities that just tells me whether they're forming antemortem or postmortem, it's just an obvious sign that something has changed in the blood and I can see it. And one of the reasons why doctors don't always see it is because doctors don't drain the vascular system and replace that fluid with a formaldehyde. I do, embalmers do. And that's where I feel like we have a moral obligation to stand up and say, hey, something's changed. And it's obvious it's changed. There's 73% of the embalmers now acknowledge this. There are what explains why don't all embalmers do it? I think cognitive dissonance. I think we're now 3 years after the fact. And people are asking me, is it changed? It's hard to say because I'm a normal person. After seeing this for 3 years, this has just become the new normal. And all of the new morticians that are in this business, this is just normal to them. They don't see anything different.
That's a good point. Yeah, those who are coming into the profession newly. And I think that's a great question. You know, we have a new condition societally, sudden adult death syndrome. Since when in history did we have that before? And our excess death rates are up all around the world. You know, we have, and unless it hits you personally or a close family member, it's hard to notice. You know, we have 3 million deaths in the U.S. every year. But when you have a 10% increase, that's 300,000 people. I mean, that's a loss of a war. And some of the greatest wars in history. So it's this slow creep of strange things happening, and no, you know, nobody wants to pull the curtain back from the wizard And you know, those who are in charge, they know what's happening. They see it. The statistics are there. As you know, Tom brought great statistics. He's a math guy, an engineer guy like me, and my background was aeronautical engineering. And you analyze systems. And when you look at the big picture, I think that's the important thing, is step back and look at the big picture. And again, I want to emphasize, don't panic, you know, take care of your health, be well, do the things you can do. But at the same time, be observant, and be caring to your neighbors. You know, we're not here to judge anyone that did or didn't get a shot. We're here to help. But we are here to point out that there's a change in pattern. And, and again, these guys have been heroic in pointing that out.
100%. You mentioned watch your vitamin D levels earlier. Several viewers want to know, what's an ideal vitamin D level?
Ideal is like 55 to 60. It's like fuel in a car tank. You burn through it every day, and it's not like you build it up and, okay, you're good. You have to replenish it. You can safely take 4,000 international units a day, according to the American Endocrine Society, without ever even getting a level checked. Generally, insurance doesn't pay for vitamin D tests. I wonder why. But, you know, check your vitamin D once or twice a year. This time of year, get outside, get as much sunshine as possible. We're in vitamin D season. There's a free app called D-Minder. Download that. You can know the best time to go outside, and with as much skin exposed as is publicly allowable, synthesize your vitamin D without offending your friend or neighbor, coworker, and then, you know, pink up a little bit and then cover up. But 55 to 60 is ideal. Some docs like their patients a little higher. Interestingly, Mayo Clinic did a study during the pandemic. Anybody that was, the lab range is 20 to 100 nanograms per milliliter. Anybody above 30 didn't even go to the ICU in their study. So that's one basic, simple thing we can all do. But we live an indoor lifestyle. 70% of the world is vitamin D insufficient or deficient. We could spend $20 billion. This is the work of Dr. Michael Anderson out of the UK. We could spend $20 billion worldwide to replenish vitamin D and save $300 billion worldwide on healthcare costs.
Any danger of going too high?
Yes.
Too much vitamin D? Yes. What happens then?
Yeah, because if your vitamin D goes high and you're not balancing vitamin D with nightly magnesium, I like magnesium bisglycinate. I also like magnesium threonate for the brain. About 400 milligrams at bedtime every night. Magnesium will push calcium back to your bones. But if you do high vitamin D without balancing it with magnesium and vitamin K2 as well, the MK7 form, your calcium will go too high in your circulation. So you really don't want to be much above 100. And some people genetically, there are about 27 variants of the vitamin D receptor where some people can't even get above 40. So, you know, it's something, it's simple. It's like a $50, $60 test. Get it checked once a year, and it's good to know where you are.
Yeah, good advice. What part of the body, asks the viewer, do the clots show up? Second question, do you see the clots in the ear canal? So many people have ear issues now, and they were wondering if clots show up there.
I've seen some, in the recent VSAFE data, I think it was ICANN requested that through a FOIA request that the VSAFE free text fields be released, and they recently have been. There's been a lot of people having nose clots coming out of their noses.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Another interesting easy scan that some clinicians will do is you can see the circulation under the tongue really easily. And you can light under the tongue and see, you know, changes in flow there. Now, the question about ear, ringing in the ear, tinnitus, obviously a problem. Now, these guys and I, nobody looks at the ear on autopsy or while embalming a body. Right. But, you know, microclots, you know, your nervous system, your ears, your nose, your eyes, your brain, highly vascular. So to form some microclots, that could be one of the causative mechanisms, certainly.
Now, in the VSAFE free text data that I've looked at the first two batches that have come public, and they've shown a lot of deep vein thrombosis. So in the legs, a lot of times those will actually move as an embolism and then come up and, you know, stroke you out or kill you with a heart attack. I've also seen a lot of more pulmonary embolisms as well. They're in that data as well. And that's corroborated by the two cath lab whistleblowers and the clots that they've sent to Dr. Philip McMillan and myself. They were deep, most of them were deep vein thrombosis or saddle PEs or I think there was actually one that was like a in the iliac region too, down in the pelvis. So they can appear all over the body, but they seem to be primarily lungs, heart, legs area.
Yeah, Joyce, that was a good question. As far as the embalmers go, we're not pathologists. So we typically utilize the major vessels. Most embalmers will either use the carotid and jugular, the iliac or femoral axillaries. Those are the major vessels. The only time that we would see some in, let's say, in the brain would be on a person did have an autopsy. And when we inject the head, those vessels are open. And we then, as we push it through, sometimes we will notice some of these small clots coming out through some of the small vessels in the back of the skull cavity. But we don't go into the heart. We don't go into the ears. We do not make incisions on the body that are unnecessary. We make the minimal amount of incisions. Those that are done in a pathology lab where they are having an autopsy, what I believe is happening, and Dr. Cole, you can maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but my belief is, because we've gotten a lot of, you know, autopsy reports, we don't get the autopsy report exactly. They determine the cause of death and they'll sit there and they'll put on there a thrombosis or an embolus or something like that. And when they see these, when they do autopsy, if they see these in their slides or their, when they take their little pieces of dissections, they're not lying. I mean, it is a thrombus or it is a embolus or something like that. But I'm wondering if, you know, are they these things? Is this it? I mean, if they cut and it's just a slice of this and that's inside and they see that under the microscope, how are they going to label that? Dr. Cole, a thrombus, embolus?
Yeah. It'll be listed as a thrombus, you know, vascular occlusion thrombus.
Yeah.
But they don't go in and analyze, you know, what's the cause of the clot or how big the clot is. But yeah, the bigger ones, the saddle emboli, we certainly see at autopsy. You'll see occasional, you know, clots in the major arteries, the heart and whatnot, but the rest of the vasculature, that's what you guys do.
Right.
One last question before we have to say goodnight. This comes from Laura Emerson. She's asking about the video that started the webinar tonight. The British embalmer said that his coroner opined that the fibrous clots were formed post-mortem. What forms post-mortem? The embalmer said this was fantasy. Can you explain?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I have a colleague who's an internist. He had two shots, was walking by his emergency room, thankfully for him, collapsed in front of the ER, and they did a thrombectomy on him, and it was pretty much a tree, a cast of his pulmonary vasculature. They saved his life. These aren't forming post-mortem. These are, like Thomas said, you know, he has vascular surgeons that are attesting now to this fact. I know a pilot that had a similar situation, and thankfully both these gentlemen are still alive. So it is pure fantasy to say that these are just forming post-mortem. If they were forming post-mortem, we would have seen these historically for years past. So something changed.
And it's interesting that the embalmers didn't start seeing them until the middle of 2021 when the vaccines rolled out in early January. So we suspect that maybe it might be 6 months at minimum for the clots to build up to the point where they cause a stroke or heart attack. And it could be as maybe as much as like 12, 18, maybe even 24 months for them to build up to that point where they do the same, because we're still seeing that even today, like I said, when most people had their jabs way back in 2021. So it may take a while for these white fibrous clots to build up to the point where they eventually do cause a stroke or heart attack.
Well, Joyce, I'd like to add one thing. I too believed, I found it very hard to imagine that these clots could be forming post-mortem. I really did, because they're so strong. They're so structurally strong. It just seemed impossible for me to believe that it could happen.
And generally, post-mortem. And if a body is sitting, you know, before it's discovered, generally you'll see like layers in a tree ring in clots that form postmortem. And we don't see that in these under the microscope. So that's just another indication that, you know, what we've seen historically in pathology is it's a different pattern.
But I know we've seen a decrease, Tom, we were looking at your numbers earlier about the decrease, a little bit decrease year to year. Do you expect, what do you expect to find in 2024?
Here's my concern.
Yeah.
Next year, they're coming out with mRNA-based shots using the lipid nanoparticle delivery system for the flu, the RSV virus, the shingle shot. Moderna's got about 40 of these things in the pipeline that they want to push out over the next few years.
All on the mRNA platform?
Yes, correct. mRNA platform shots. I'm worried that that percentage is going to go right back up again if we start releasing more of these mRNA-based shots.
It's not just the spike protein from this virus. I think that's an important point. They have polyethylene glycol. When we're doing blood banking, what do we use PEG for? We use it to actually cause hemagglutination, a clotting reaction. The lipid nanoparticle in and of itself is unsafe for numerous reasons. And basically, your human cells are meant to make human proteins. Your human cells are not to be hacked and express foreign proteins. So whether it's for flu, RSV, for any other infectious agent, to induce the body with a gene to make foreign proteins will always make your cells a target of your own immune system's attack. So, it's not just that these shots should have gone off the market, you know, back in January of 21, they never should have made it to market. But going forward, one has to be very astute and aware that this is the technology they want to use. It's unproven. Obviously, we have oodles of harms that have hit the world. And so we need to push forward to stop this platform altogether. It was conceptually interesting from a research point of view, but to use it as a vaccine program was, it was the epitome of hubris. And we need to, I think, be very astute going forward in terms of trust to the medical system and not trust this platform in any way, shape, or form.
It feels sometimes like, on this issue and others that we've faced at the FLCCC and throughout the world with other organizations, that we are just shouting into the abyss. And it just feels, I don't want to say it feels hopeless, but the frustration people feel and the knowledge that the people who are purveying these mRNA goods to market know what we know, but yet here we are.
Here we are. But I think what you're doing, what we're all doing is so critically important, because each time we wake somebody up, we're saving a life. And we're, I think, improving our society, improving our general understanding, our general knowledge. We're being good friends, good neighbors by seeing something and saying something.
That it really does boil down to that. I've kept you gentlemen a little too long, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being with us tonight. Major Thomas Haviland, Richard Hirschman, and our good friend, as always, Dr. Ryan Cole, thank you for guest hosting tonight. It was a privilege and a pleasure for me. I really do appreciate it. So thank you, gentlemen. We do have a couple of announcements. Thank you. We do have a couple of announcements before we say goodnight to all of you. We know that this topic has been circulating for some years now, and we are so glad that these guests tonight were able to join us to help shed more light on this. This is what we mean when we say honest medicine, so you can believe it. As always, our team has been busy behind the scenes creating new guides, with Mental Health Awareness Month starting in May, which is just next week. Oh my gosh, it's next week. That's right. We wanted to share these with you. Brain Health, a guide to cognitive impairment. Managing Depression, which looks at nutraceutical and non-pharmacological interventions, and the brand new Brain and Mental Health Guide that includes tips to help you enhance your memory and focus and to improve your mood. All are very important today, perhaps more than ever, as we've seen tonight. Please check these out on our website using the links on the screen and make certain to share with friends and family who may be in need of this information. Actually, I think everyone is in need of this information. And we have one more new guide to share with you. This is a good one. This one covers allergies, allergy intolerances, food sensitivities, and more. You can learn about the range of symptoms, common types of allergens, and what you can begin to do today to seek help and get healthier if you are struggling with any of the above. You can find it under the Tools and Guides tab on our website, or use the QR code or link on the screen. With that, let's bring up our lovely nurse tonight. Oh, actually, nurses, we have Samantha Hanks. I know you've been busy in the Q&A platform, Samantha. And I know Christina is watching from afar, not necessarily in the trenches with it tonight. But first of all, good wishes to you, Christina. I know you're with family who needs some medical help, and we're just always glad to see you here. And we wish your family, as you know, as
I'll be reporting back from the front lines later, Joyce. So
that's great. That's great. I appreciate you being
here. Samantha can tell us all about what the questions tonight. Go on, Samantha.
Yes.
Yeah, lots of good questions. You know, I think we would love to have those guys back on and maybe just do a Q&A with them, because there's a lot of things that we just can't answer. They're the ones on the front lines kind of seeing this daily. So that might be something to look forward to in the future with them.
What were some of the questions you think will come up in a future episode with these guests?
You know, just hopefully we get better diagnostics. And with good reason, right? Because now we've got all this information that this is happening, we're seeing this, what do we do about it? You know, what can people do? And we have really no answers yet as far as accessible and easy testing, blood testing, imaging. We don't really have that yet. So I think that that's something that hopefully will come forward in the future. But what can we do about it besides we have natokinase, getting your vitamin D levels up? I mean, it's great not to worry about it, but I think that's something that that we'll have to address kind of as we go forward.
Definitely, definitely. I know that Dr. Cole mentioned symptoms to watch for. So that's something also that you just be mindful of what you're feeling and what you're experiencing and report that to your doctor. But anyway, thank you for all you do, both of you, all the time. Thank you for being with us as always. Thanks. So our dear FLCCC family, as always, we want to thank you all so much for supporting us here in all we do. We couldn't do this without you. We say this every week, but we mean it so deeply, and we are so blessed by you. So we will see you back here next week for another great discussion. But before that, stay tuned for a short My Story from Dr. Jessica Tran. She's a naturopathic physician who expresses her gratitude for the honest medicine she found here at the FLCCC. Good night, everyone.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jessica Tran, and I am located in Southern California. I'm a licensed naturopathic doctor. I just want to share my greatest appreciation to the FLCCC for all their contributions and guidelines and commitment to medical freedom. And I could not be more grateful for the staff and everyone here who has put this conference together to make it just so not only joyous, but also coming together, putting our, doesn't matter what title we have as a medical provider, whether you're a medical doctor, DO, chiropractor, nurse practitioner, nurse, or anyone who is caring for patients, we're putting patients first and committing to honest medicine. So I can't wait to see where we're going to go in the future.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send it in to mystory@flcc.net.